Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's something strange that happens with homelessness. There's something strange that happens in war. And there's something strange that happens in prisons, which are these very extreme sets of circumstances.
You've done all three.
You get to see the absolute worst of society and the absolute worst that humanity can do. But at the same time, you get to see the most incredible humanity. The, like, what people are really, truly capable of in these sets of circumstances.
Hello and welcome to Changes. It is Annie McManus here, bringing you an episode that I hope will be very memorable for you. I cannot think of a better guest for Changes than Chelsea Manning, our guest this week. Chelsea's name, gender, anonymity, and freedom all changed irrevocably in her 20s. But she is most well known for one particular event. It was 2010. Chelsea was 22 years old and working as a data analyst for the US Army. She was stationed in Iraq. But on this day, she was back in Virginia on leave. Chelsea went to a Barnes & Noble bookstore and uploaded 500,000 classified US military documents to WikiLeaks using the Barnes & Noble free Wi-Fi. She has always claimed that she released the information for the public interest. Upon returning to Iraq, the repercussions were swift and brutal. Prior to her trial, she was kept in military prison for 3 years, 11 months of those being kept in solitary confinement. This involved being in a windowless 6-meter cell for 23 hours a day. Initially, she was on suicide watch, meaning she wasn't allowed to sit down. She was allowed no possessions or bed sheets even, and at times was sometimes forced to go without even her underwear. Unbeknownst to her, Chelsea, in the public sphere, was a divisive figure. Some celebrated her for trying to expose human rights abuses in the military. Some condemned her as a traitor. After those initial 3 years, she was sentenced to 35 years in prison. Soon after the sentencing, she came out publicly as a trans woman. In 2017, 7 years into her sentence, Chelsea sent President Obama a letter pleading for her release. Obama listened and finally commuted her sentence. Chelsea has since written a memoir called readme.txt, referring to the file name she used for the leaks. There's also a documentary called XY Chelsea on Amazon Prime and Apple TV. Chelsea now lives in Brooklyn and joined me back at the start of September to talk through the monumental changes in her life. I started by asking her how the first time on deployment in Iraq changed her perspective on the war and the world.
So I considered myself to be a very educated and informed citizen, right?
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't necessarily political. I like to say that in my late teens and early 20s, my politics were leave Britney alone, you know, because I was kind of apolitical. I didn't really have, like, even whenever it became the centerpiece of the national conversation within the U.S., which was, you know, the war in Iraq is spiraling out of control at this time. It's 2006, 2007. And I'm in my moment where I don't know who I am, right? I'm trying to figure that out. And I had just gone through this chaotic journey of the last 3 or 4 years of my late teens, which were very chaotic. I lived in the UK for a period of time. I lived with my father for a period of time. I didn't have a home for several months. And then I finally found that I was sort of living with my aunt, but I was like just trying to ground myself. And so I was really looking for purpose and meaning, and I was kind of lost. And so I sort of latched on to this national conversation. And I was like, oh, well, you know, somebody needs me somewhere, right?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Maybe. So I, with some back and forth between myself and my father, who I was trying to rekindle our relationship with, because we'd kind of fallen out, just trying to like reestablish our relationship. And he was a Navy guy. So he was just like, you should really enlist in either the Navy or the Air Force. I wanted to participate in that, but I also knew that the real action in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan was in the Army and the Marine Corps. And so I went over to the Marine Corps recruiting center, and the Marine Corps wasn't there. They were off that day. So I ended up going into the Army recruiting center.
So arbitrary, isn't it?
And I did that, because our Army, Navy don't get along.
Yeah.
So I was in a sense, like trying to one up my dad a little bit.
So it was kind of still doing roughly what he wanted, but your way.
Right.
Yeah.
And I really enlisted in the military to grapple with things that I did that I didn't know how to grapple with. So I basically just sort of threw them off onto the military shoulder, in my mind, which was to, have structure and have, the military sort of tell me where I need to go and how to live. So that way I wouldn't have to deal with, things like, who I am or where I belonged or where I fit in the world. Because these are all like burning questions that I had within myself. Like, why do I have this feeling that the gender that I present as publicly and every day in my line of work, why does this feel so uncomfortable? Why did I have this this real gut feeling of just sort of like, this can't be right. And then I'm faced with, the life and death every single day. Like, it was just, I often like to say that, in a war or a combat environment, there's sort of a cheapness to life because it becomes this, it just sort of becomes a statistic. Like, so many people living and dying every, on such an unfathomable scale every day, that one of the things that's really changed for me fundamentally is I don't really care what other people think anymore or what society's expectations are anymore, because it really doesn't matter. And I think even afterwards, when I, which we could talk about later, I went to prison for 7 years. That really solidified even further and crystallized in me. And so whenever it comes to the sort of the change of how I perceive the war in Iraq, I didn't know. I really didn't know. And even the training that was provided for us, it was very statistical, it was very sort of methodical, it was very abstract. It took an understanding of what was going on, an untangling, and a real on the ground sort of understanding. Like, you have to see faces and see neighborhoods. And, I remember flying in the Black Hawk helicopters, which we would be transported to and from, and looking over at neighborhoods of Eastern Baghdad and knowing the neighborhoods and being able to physically see it, to smell it, and to know that there are real places and that there are real things, and also to know, sort of read between the lines with reporting and understanding what's really going on, including the things that aren't necessarily written down, to have that experience and to have that really jarring processing period between what the public knew or thought they knew or understood versus the reality, and how gigantic this chasm was,
that discrepancy, right?
And I find it funny because people now understand it better. It was tainted before, but because it's had this sort of taint removed from it, we've forgotten that it was once, glossed over and varnished in such a way.
I mean, can you be more specific about those discrepancies in terms of what the American public were being told through the media and what you were seeing? Like, what was the difference there?
I can't. That's sort of the complexity that exists here is I did it once and I got in trouble and I can't do it again or I'll get in trouble again. But I can tell you the feeling that I had, and it was alarming. It was very jarring. Even when I was on leave, or even when I was talking with people back home, it was like they had forgotten about it by this point because there was a new administration, because this was seen as like George W. Bush's war, right? There's sort of the perception among the public that this is George W. Bush's war. And we were in the Obama administration by this point. So it was the early Obama years. And nothing had really changed. Like, really? Like, the policies hadn't really changed. the on the ground reality hadn't changed, just sort of like the perception of it had changed. And that I found that very jarring, because like I would be like, yeah, I'm, you know, I've been deployed to Iraq and I've been deployed to Iraq for months now. And people would be like, oh, we're still there? There was this deep sort of feeling of like, oh no, there's something really wrong here.
So zooming in to the 8th of February, 2010, Tyson's Corner Center, a mall in Virginia, which you visited whilst on leave from your job, you uploaded those files, those classified files.
Which almost didn't happen.
I know. I mean, it's literally like something that Jason Bourne, the start of your book. You're like, oh my God, will she get those up in time? She's got to catch her flight.
Well, I mean, I think it's funny because people, you know, often tell me like, oh, it's like a thriller. And I'm like, well, in the moment, it felt pretty like normal. Like, you know, it was like,
how?
Because it's life, you know, like life is complicated. Life is messy. Life is jarring. I mean, it was like,
did you feel fear when it was happening? I mean, it's 12 hours, so there's plenty of time to feel all the feelings while you were uploading it. But like, how did you feel going through that? Did you feel a change as that information was off your shoulders and in the world as such?
I think I really wasn't able to process any of it, you know, as all of this was happening. And, you know, like, because I didn't really, like, everything happened. So, like, from my perspective, like, everything was just sort of a problem. And I was like, okay, I have a problem that's right in front of me. This problem needs to be solved, which is dig car out of snow, right? You know, transport car to, you know, another location, look for internet. You know, it's like very sort of like objective based and scenario based, you know. And I, like, you kind of tell, like, I have this, you know, I still have this sort of like military, like, you know, sort of like objective, like following.
Yeah, regimented plan.
It's very procedural, right? You know,
and
and so like that's how I get through things. Like that's how I got through whenever I, because eventually like I went into prison and you know, then became like a you know, surviving solitary confinement. You know, like I need to eat food. I need to, you know, I need to drink water. And you know, like that's my brain. That's where my brain is. And I latched onto this. All of the emotional stuff, which I'm sure is there, but you know, I've had a therapist explain this to me, like that I went through long periods of alexithymia, which is like an inability to like grasp or understand the emotions that you're feeling, because you're just you're just making everything into a puzzle or a challenge, and working through that. And it really wasn't until very recently, probably the last 5 or 6 years, that I've really been able to disentangle some of that.
Let's go to young Chelsea in Oklahoma and focus on this first change that we ask every guest on this podcast. What is the biggest change of your childhood, please?
That would be my parents' divorce.
Okay. How old were you?
I was, I think, 10 or 11.
And what kind of a kid were you?
So I was really into math. I was really into science. I was an academic high achiever. You know, I was on the basketball team, and I wasn't the greatest at sports, but I tried really hard. So that became like where I put a lot of my eggs in the like value basket, because you know, the reality was is that my life at home was very difficult.
So what did home, you had a sister, right?
I had a sister. So my sister had moved out by then, though. I still saw her regularly, but she was living on her own in a different town. And so my parents were still the bedrock of my existence, really, you know. And I had this assumption that Not only was our home the way that every home was, like it was all the same, you know, like I was like, oh, every kid goes through this existence, but also that it was not changing, that it was, you know, that I would have my mother be at home and my father would come home from work or be traveling and come home. And that was the way it was always going to be. And the jarring thing was that was whenever my parents started to fall apart. The relationship started to fall apart. My mother had a suicidal episode, and my father found a new relationship, and my mother wanted desperately to move back to the UK. And so I had all of these seismic life changes happen in about a year to a year and a half period of my life.
Right. And how did that practically manifest? What happened next for you? Where did you live? What happened?
So I ended up living in the UK, which is a foreign country for me at this time.
It was rural.
It was rural Southwest Wales, right? You know, which is, you know, I love Pembrokeshire, but you know, it's definitely a jarring change from rural central Oklahoma. And so I had these very jarring changes, like culturally, educationally, the expectations that were on me, like everything had just gone completely off the rails in my life.
And your dad was gone. So you moved to Wales with your mom. So that's important to say that it was just you and your mom at this point.
It was. So it was my mother yeah. And you know, I guess it was a package with, you know, my mother's like sisters as well. So I had, okay. I had a number of aunts.
Do you mind talking about the relationship between you and your dad as well? Because I mean, you mentioned there about trying to kind of, you know, win his favor after an argument. What was that like, you and your dad? And how did the relationship ebb and flow as such throughout this time?
When I was younger, I always just wanted my father to love me and to respect me and to like tell me, you're doing good. You are, I'm proud of you. And he just wasn't capable of that. And no matter how hard I tried academically, no matter how well I did at, you know, building something or working on something or achieving something, no matter what achievements I had, it just never really ever was enough. He was very hypercritical. I remember I built this gigantic Eiffel Tower out of Lego pieces. It was like 3 feet tall, which, you know, at like 6 or 7 years old was this achievement. And I think it was like 7 or 8 years old. And, he, you know, he's like, oh, it's the wrong color. Right. And to that, for somebody of that young, you know, that's just like a gut punch. It's an emotional gut punch to like the first thing that you get after this massive accomplishment is just sort of an immediate criticism. And and, you know, we had good times. And I want to be clear, like, my father was very good. He was very good at sitting down and teaching me things. Like, he taught me how to use computers. He taught me, you know, he was very good at helping with homework. And that was why I wanted to achieve so much academically. Because, you know, he would like, walk me through things and, like, pique my interest in things. And was really good at sitting down and walking me through problems and problem solving. But, like, any kind of emotional support or availability, just not there.
No, not there. And he was a drinker, right?
Increasingly, yes. Right. I would say that both of my parents, you know, became much more dependent on alcohol as I was getting older. And it became very abusive. You know, it got to a point where my father would even be violent and aggressive, you know, being drunk and being like extremely unpredictable, you know, and this was around when I was like 10 or 11. And so this is like around the time whenever my parents started to split up, you know, they both just fell into the bottle.
Yeah. Having done the work now, you know, as a 35-year-old woman and kind of worked through so much and gone to therapy, have you figured out how those years have kind of manifested in you and how to kind of move through them as such?
Sure. You know, now whenever I achieve something or I accomplish something, it's my accomplishment, right? You know, that's something I had to learn. It wasn't to impress my father, right? It wasn't to get his attention. It was, you know, oh, I've done something. I can feel proud in myself of that. You know, because like I can be super self-critical. Like it's almost like my father like taught me how to find the problems in things rather than, you know, very glass half empty mentality. Yeah. I've learned how to, I've had to be like, oh, I'm viewing this as like, I'm being kind of pessimistic or hypercritical. I should look for the good.
So you moved to Wales, then you moved back to America after a couple of years, right?
Yeah.
You then moved into your father's house with his new partner. That didn't go so well. And then there was some time when you were homeless. reading the book, I just felt for you so bad because you're trying, you're working in a, what was it, Abercrombie and Fitch or something? Like
I had two jobs. Starbucks? Yeah. I had Starbucks was my main job, yeah.
Yeah, and then you were trying to go to college.
Yep, so I was. I counted it once, and I was either doing work or school for over 100 hours a week. So very little sleep.
Very little sleep, trying to make ends meet, trying to do both, and it wasn't sustainable, basically. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, I mean, I often joke because people often say, oh, well, you know, you were in the military. And I'm like, well, the hardest job I ever had was actually Starbucks and doing a closing slash opening, right? You know, where you close one night and you open first thing in the morning, right? You know, when did I get to go out? When did I get to go have fun?
Yeah. So at what point did you end up leaving your father and his partner's house? And what were the circumstances of that?
I was working at a job and I would come home from work every day. She had a son who, you know, had this very regimented, scheduled because of various, you know, sort of neurodivergences that he had that I'm not terribly familiar with, and I never got a chance to really learn. But, you know, I was fairly independent of that, I felt. But there was always this clash between, like, okay, like, I need to go eat and I need to cook because it's like 8 p.m. She was like, well, you can't cook in here. It's past 8 p.m. and you can't be doing this and that, doing this. And I'm like, well, I have to eat. Like, I can't not eat. So I kept pushing and I kept pushing these boundaries, and it eventually led to a fight. And she, like, aggressively sort of was screaming at me one day, and I, you know, and I yelled back at her. And this was around the time when my father had prostate cancer.
Okay.
So he had just had surgery to remove a tumor. And so he was out of commission, essentially. And I feel like she used this time when he was sort of drugged
up. Heavily medicated, yeah.
Heavily medicated and unable to, like, understand what was going on. And she, like, accused me of, you know, like, threatening her or something like that. And, you know, it was like, it was an argument, but she used that opportunity to call the police and bring, you know, and in Oklahoma, and this is where the legal system, this is my first sort of encounter with the American legal system in all of its complexity and arbitrariness. If there's a domestic call, there has to be somebody removed. Doesn't matter if it's frivolous or not, there has to be somebody removed.
Wow.
And so I was physically removed from the property, and I never returned. And all I had was a truck and the stuff that was in boxes. And as much as my sister would have loved to have taken me in at the time, you know, she had just finished college, she had just gotten married, and, you know, they were struggling.
Yeah.
You know, they had just gotten started. I left and I went on this journey across the central United States for the next 6 or 8 months.
And ended up in Chicago.
I ended up landing in Chicago, yeah. And it was funny because I kept on going to bigger and bigger places because I was sort of seeking that anonymity.
I mean, at this time in Chicago, you write about discovering the club scene and really finding a home. And a kind of sense of community in the gay clubs there, the music, the people, like, just really, can you tell me about kind of how that felt for you after a very turbulent teens, I suppose?
Yeah, well, you know, after everything and after losing essentially everything, because I had nothing.
Yeah.
I was
in, very vulnerable, like living in a truck, basically.
At this age, my brain didn't process that as, like, I'm in danger or I'm at risk.
Yeah.
I process it as that, as this is an adventure.
Right.
This is life.
Yeah.
This is, you know, exciting.
Yeah.
And so I really latched on to this scene because anything could happen, you know. And, you know, sure, it was scary and it was uncertain. And, you know, there were days and nights when I was like, oh, how am I going to eat or do anything? But there was also, like, the sense of, like, adventure as I'm meeting new people all the time and I'm getting to go and explore new places and experience new things. The artistic nature of the scene and the sort of, like, the complexities of the community and the sort of the style, the fashion, the music. And, you know, I mean, despite the fact I was living as a fairly destitute person, I didn't dress like it. You know, I had a chance to, I had a chance to be, to live and express myself in ways that I never was able to before.
Right, right. That's so important, isn't it? It's giving you this freedom to...
Yeah, when you're not paying rent, you could definitely spend money on clothes.
Yeah.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So then you join the military. We know you ended up joining the army. We know about that leave. Let's talk about what happened next. I mean, your adult change is kind of after that period. You know, that change from being someone who was well-intentioned, well-meaning, working in the military, taking your job really seriously, to then being arrested by that same military. And as you said, put in solitary confinement, not knowing what's going on, what's happening to you.
And being very surprised by that.
You know,
I think one of the things that I often like have to remind people is that had never happened before.
Right.
Because people now have this, like, because now they look at me or they look at Ed's case.
Edward Snowden,
Right. And so they look at these sort of big cases after 2010. But, I didn't know who Daniel Ellsberg was, right? Mm. And he never went to prison.
And
right?
Daniel Ellsberg was another person who, like, a whistleblower kind of person, yes.
Right, from the Vietnam era, you know, and I didn't even know about this, like that this had happened. So there's this like pre-internet sort of like, you know, lack of information, this information void that we were in. But like this had never happened before because people are like, oh, what did you expect? And I was like, I thought I'd get in trouble, for sure. But I thought it was career ending, you know, which is everything. When that's all you have is your career, like that's everything.
Yeah.
So like that was the end of my life. But yeah. The solitary confinement, the lengthy prison sentence, the lack of connections, like all of that had never happened before.
Yeah.
And was very unexpected.
Yeah.
Because it's just not how it had panned out in other cases. You know, other cases prior to that, you know, if they were out of jail, you know, had lawyers and they had teams and things like that. So I kind of expected my experience to be similar. Like I would get in a lot of trouble, but that would be trouble as in like, am I gonna have a job after this? Anybody gonna ever employ me again? I'm never gonna have retirement. Like those are the kinds of scary realities that I was gonna have to grapple with. So to this day, I struggle processing like what happened to me.
Yeah. So you were in a solitary confinement for 11-ish months. Then you were sentenced to a 35-year sentence. How old were you when you were sentenced, Chelsea?
So I was 25 years old. And I had been in prison for 3 years, so, you know.
So you thought you might get life without parole if you were accused of treason, correct? And you weren't.
Well, so there's aiding the enemy, which is a quote-unquote treasonable offense. But we got past that.
Like, yeah.
I was acquitted of that charge, which, again, way outside the bounds of anything I was even fathoming before that. But, you know, that was off the table. So like, I had numbers. So I was like, this is a range. I can work with numbers and you can calculate from that. So it just became sort of a math problem to me at that point. Hmm. But like the idea that I would walk about in my 30s or my 40s was far outside the realm of possibility. So, but I had come to expect that. So, you know, by the time that happened, I was like, okay, like, you know, like I got some numbers. This is what I got to do. Like, you know, here's how I'm going to try to, now I just got to figure out how I'm going to get through the next like 20 years 20, 25 years, because there is a mandatory minimum. I lived under this sort of expectation, like, it's going to be a long time. Probably not going to get out of prison, but what I can do is I can improve my conditions while I'm in there. And I can make my life in prison
bearable,
as livable as possible.
Yeah. So it was at that moment, like, after you were convicted, that you then decided to come out as trans and say, I am Chelsea. Like, this is who I am now. Am I right?
Well, I wanted to do it sooner. It probably wasn't until 2-3 months after I got incarcerated that I even knew that people knew who I was, right?
Okay.
Because I'd been that isolated. But around that time when I was like, oh, like, people know me as, like, a different name and a different sort of background. And also people, I read this, like, New York Times piece that people were describing as, like, a loner. And I'm like, who is this person they're describing? Right? You know? I was like, I'm a party person. What are we talking about here? Like, where's the club? Where's the music? But there was a sort of jarring sort of thing where I'm just like, okay, like, it's what I want to do. But it was through my legal counsel, who was just like, this is about your survival right now. This is not about, like, your access to care and things like that. I'm like, okay, like, but as soon as that's out of the way, as soon as I know where this court martial and this sentence lands, this is what I need to get done. And so I was very adamant that I wanted it. I wanted to come out. I wanted to seek care. I wanted to, you know, get the transition care that I needed. But it was pretty clear that every single resource possible needed to be focused on the court martial process. But as soon as that was out of the way, I was like, yeah, this is my priority. Quality of life was my priority.
Of course. So being able to live as yourself. And when you made that statement and said, no, this is who I am, I'm Chelsea Manning, I guess, how did things change for you? Was there a reaction? Did people react to what you said? And how did it change how you felt, I suppose?
I had no idea how much my story and my experience would resonate with sort of other trans people, or that there was a trans community, because, like, that notion was fairly recent, right? And so this connectedness was new, and this sort of understanding of this, like, people reaching out to me was brand new. And I was a bit taken aback at first by that, like, oh, people have similar experiences to me. Wow. But, you know, in my day-to-day life, nothing changed. Like, you know, prison was the same rigmarole as it always was.
But I was struck on reading your story at the courage that you had in order to present as a woman in prison, you know.
Why?
Because you're surrounded by men. I don't know. To me, that automatically feels like you're vulnerable. Like, you know, presenting as a woman, I feel like people would, like, I don't know, want to attack you or something. This is my instinct. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, no, I feel like I'm far more vulnerable if I didn't, right?
If you didn't.
Yeah.
Okay,
exactly.
I see.
You know, like, if you don't, like, especially in prison, like, in an environment where you're around the same people every single day, you're already doing that in the military, and it's that times two, right? So I like to say, imagine secondary school, except you can't leave and there's no classes, right? All the drama, all of the complexity, all of the personalities become very known. And if you're not who you are and not presenting as who you are, everyone can see that. You could see that about each other.
I'd say it would be exhausting as well.
Yeah, just exactly.
To have to lie. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, it was easier for me to be who I was. And it was easier for everyone else because, like, oh, yeah, like, this is you quite clearly. You know?
Yeah.
And
how do people like take to you? Like, you were transitioning in prison. You were the first person in the military prison system granted access to hormones, one of a handful of the military at large.
Yeah.
This was, you know, relatively new, you know,
it was
as a concept within military prison.
Yeah. And well, it was certainly a fight. But you know, whenever it came to, like, cause I think people have a very incorrect perception of inmates, right? You know, and the priorities of inmates, right? You know, inmates were like, you know, like, people are like, oh, were you scared of inmates? I was like, no, not really. Like, they were, you know, how do they react to it? And they're like, oh, you got one over on the prison system? You went up against the system and won? Like, that's great. Like, this is like, it's the solidarity that I think that's missing from the story here of the prison system, right?
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, like, we're all in this together. And yeah, of course we want to see more rights among prisoners. And yeah, you get one over, like, this sort of, like, David versus Goliath aspect becomes so important to the story internally. One of the battles that I didn't win was, you know, the ability to grow my hair. And it was it was hard because, you know, it was like everything else is like, this is the one thing that the prison system didn't want to relent on. And the reason why they didn't relent on it was because they were afraid that they were going to allow, you know, indigenous inmates to have to grow their hair, or they were going to have to provide religious exceptions for people. Okay. So they stuck on this point, and it was, and I had solidarity with the other inmates who wanted the same right, you know, for a different reason, But like, you know, they were like, oh yeah, we're going to make this as pain. We're going to make this as painless as possible. So, you know, I got hooked up with a barber who would stretch the rules to the very limit, you know, only would use shears, would not use buzzers, you know, like somebody who would who would, like, you know, make it as comfortable an experience as possible, you know.
And you described someone threading your eyebrows, which is a very touching moment.
Yeah, because he needed the skills to do that and needed to be qualified to do that, because under Kansas barber official, you know, certification, you have to learn how to do that. So, yeah, you get to practice, you know.
As every year goes by and you live longer as a free woman, those 7 years will feel smaller and smaller. Well, oh my God, Chelsea. Okay, now we're getting
this. And this is, but this is what I grapple with, right? You know?
Okay.
You know, which is,
how do you mean? So, like, in terms of what?
Well,
how are we not free?
You know, and that's what I mean is, like, I, you know, whenever I was living on the streets, right, of Chicago, right, you know, it was the same sort of mentality of like, you know, like, oh, this is an adventure. It was how I perceived the situation. You know, I felt more free then than I've ever felt at any point in my life. And that holds to this day, right? You know?
And why is that?
Why is that? The obligations that I have as an adult, the rent, the bills, the social expectations that are placed on me. And now I have these social expectations that are placed on me as a public figure. Like, oh, you should you should be doing this. You should have these social media accounts. You should have a TikTok. You should do YouTube.
Right.
You know, like, you should do this. You know, I mean, it's very philosophical. You know, you can get into, like, postmodern philosophy, but, like, just in terms of, like, my own life experience, I'm like, yeah, like, what is free? And why is it that when I was reading and I was learning the legal system in the law library and I was working in a wood shop, why did I feel more free in general population in prison? Not solitary confinement, but when I was in general population, why did I feel more free and more fulfilled than I do as an adult who's paying rent and bills and having to do all these, like, social obligations? Why is that?
Just talking about how you felt about being in prison, there's a scene in the amazing film that you can watch on Amazon Prime, XY Chelsea, of where you're called to be told that Obama has commuted your sentence and you will be coming out of prison. And you're not whooping. You're not like, woohoo. You're like, oh, but I've got all my friends here and it's going to be weird. And, you know, you can palpably hear a sadness in your voice. A kind of like, oh, can you talk to me more about, I suppose, you know, you said you felt free, but...
No, I didn't. I didn't feel free. I didn't feel free. I want to be clear.
A sense of free. Yeah. A sense of free. Is that
I felt more purpose.
Like a sense of freedom. Got you.
I felt more fulfillment. I felt more spiritual connection.
And also, I presume, a sense of community in there. A very, like, solid sense of community. Did you have that?
Yeah. Like, I could just meet any random person and we could play spades and have conversations and I could learn something.
And did you have... Did you have meaningful relationships in there? Like, are you still in touch with people from there?
They're very strict about the rules on that kind of thing. And most people aren't like me. They don't get severed. Like, they end up in the system and they continually have to be a part of the system. So even when somebody goes to a different facility, you very rarely hear from anyone ever again. But sure, am I nostalgic about those moments? Yeah, absolutely. As Solzhenitsyn observed, you know, like, it's a microcosm of our society. And I think that's true. There's something strange that happens with homelessness. There's something strange that happens in war. And there's something strange that happens in prisons, which are these very extreme sets of circumstances.
You've done all three.
You get to see the absolute worst of society and the absolute worst that humanity can do. But at the same time, you get to see the most incredible humanity. The, like, what people are really, truly capable of in these sets of circumstances.
Well, let's get to the biggest change of your adult life. You kind of cited two changes that came back to back. What were they?
Well, they were my first time being released from prison into the public, and then being a public figure.
Both at the same time, which must have been a complete head fuck.
Yeah, well, it's funny because this is a part of the story that I think gets glossed over and overlooked, which, you know, again, is a part of the story from like the start when I was in solitary confinement, which is like, I don't know anybody knows I'm here, right? And it's like, it's like apparently all over the evening news globally, right? It's like international firestorm. And I'm sitting in there and I'm like, I wonder what's for breakfast, right? I have no idea.
Yeah.
And it's the same sort of thing where it's like, I have no idea how to do a television interview, and yet I'm expected to know automatically how to do the kinds of television interviews that people prepare for years, that spend entire careers trying to be prepared for, and I have to learn how to do this in 10 days. There was this moment where I was released from prison, and I thought, oh, I'm right off into the sunset. Like, literally, like, okay, like, I guess this is that's that chapter of my life over, and this, we can fade out.
There's a quote in the book, you say, it did feel surreal to be free, but it also felt like what I'd been dealing with for the previous 7 years would never be over. It certainly isn't over now. I can never leave it behind.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that it will fade, much like a scar. I like to think of it akin to a scar, you know, like it will, it will heal. But it will always be there. It will fade, but it will always be there.
How has it changed you ultimately? Do you think, you know, that period of time in prison, how has it manifested in you as Chelsea now? The memories will fade. Has it changed you, kind of the essence of who you are, how you look at the world, how you move through the world?
Sure. When I felt alone and I felt like I didn't have guidance, I now encounter so many people who are lost and needing guidance or whatever, and I don't feel that anymore. I don't feel lost anymore, and I think that's real, and I think that's deep, and that's powerful. Is I don't feel lost. I know right where I am, and I know right where I need to be. Am I a little off course from time to time? Sure, but I know who I am. I know what I enjoy. I know what I like and what I don't like. I know what my true ambitions are, and I found like a real sense of who I am. And I do feel a little sidetracked by some of the obligations that I have, both as just being sort of a quote unquote free adult in the world, and as a public figure from time to time. But I get the sense, especially when I'm interacting with people and I get to talk to people, that I feel way more grounded than everyone else.
So that brings us really nicely into the final question of change, the change you would still like to make in your life moving forwards, or that you are working on.
Oh, that's a great question. I've accomplished so many of the things that I've wanted to do in my life. You know, I ran out of dreams to fulfill, right? Weirdly enough.
You got to make some new ones, Chelsea.
I mean, do I? You know, I've had this struggle, you know, for the last year or so. I mean, I think that stability, I mean, like that's, I mean, like, and I said this before, which is like stability is like what I'm really after. And I'm starting to get that. I'm starting to get a taste of that stability, and I want it. I want that stability. And I know that that's going against the grain of sort of like everything else that's going on in society as things become more unstable. But like, I want a piece of that stability and a bit of that peace of mind for as long as I can for myself, and so I can heal, and so I can find my place in all of this that isn't attached to stuff that happened 15 years ago. You know, that's mainly what I've been doing. So it's more finding, you know, that internal piece, which I've finally sort of made a lot of progress on in the last few years. And now I'm turning that into, okay, what do I want in my home? What kind of relationships do I want? And it goes back to the very beginning of this, which is, after my parents divorced, I lost that stability, and that's what I want back. And I can do that now.
Are you still in touch with your parents? Are they both still around?
My mother passed away in 2020, sadly.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I have not seen my father in over a decade. I haven't heard from him or spoken to him, I think, in like about 5 or 6, maybe 7 years, probably since I was released. That's not because of something on my part, right?
Sure.
I mean, I've sort of let go of the fact that I'm probably never going to have like a really good relationship with my father. But like, you know, that doesn't mean I wouldn't talk to him. But even other members of my family who I do talk to, you know, on a more regular basis, don't really know what's going on with him. So he's still mercurial. So
he's out there. And, you know, you've got a long life ahead. You never know. You seem so well and buoyant and just in such good form. And it's so wonderful to have this time with you and to share those ideas and for you to share your story. I really appreciate that because I can't imagine it's fun going back there over and over again. So I do appreciate your generosity in doing that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Chelsea Manning. As I mentioned, if you want to find out more about Chelsea's story, read her memoir. It's excellent, so beautifully written, as you can imagine, incredibly gripping, such as the kind of huge drama of her life. It's called readme.txt, and you can also watch her documentary XY Chelsea on Amazon Prime or Apple TV. Do please rate, review and subscribe to Changes. It is so appreciated. And if you fancy sharing it on social media too, that would be amazing. The more people we can get listening to these episodes, the better. We want to tell our stories far and wide. Changes is produced by Louise Mason through DIN Productions. And I'll be back next week with more. See you then.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.